Tonight on Arena, challengers that they may face the Rising Sun and Prospect House are the movies up for review, and singer Judy Jackson on the song she'll be bringing to the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. Film reviews tonight. We will have Pat Collins's IFTA award-winning film that they may face the Rising Sun. We spoke to Pat earlier in the week, of course. The film was adapted to the John McGahern novel of the same name. It tells the story of a rural lakeside community in which the lives of a newly returned couple, Joe and Kate Rutledge, played by Barry Ward and Anna Berdica, are centre stage. Next up, Challengers, an American rom-com starring Mike Fist as a professional tennis champion who plots a comeback with the help of his wife, a former tennis prodigy played by Zendaya, as he takes on another tennis star, Josh O'Connor, who is a former friend of his and his wife's ex-boyfriend. That's a triple-sided triangle, if we can have such a thing. And finally, another Irish film, this time a comedy directed, a kind of comedy and drama, I would argue, directed by Paul Mercier, Prospect House, about a group of protesters that set out to save a derelict 18th century building by making a period film inside. The cast stars Barry Ward once again, along with Paul Reed, Dara Devani, as egos, arguments, relationships and money constraints get in the way of their plan. Dave Hanratty, Dee Malumbi have seen all three. And they're with me in studio right now. Let's start with the film adaptation of John McGahern's novel That They May Face the Rising Sun, his final novel telling the story of 1 year in the life of a lakeside community in County Leitrim. You know, if I say to you, tell me the plot of this, there's not really a lot to tell because it's just not about plot, Dee.
I would kind of struggle to describe the plot of this movie, but in kind of broad strokes, I suppose, you're looking at a couple, Joe and Kate, who are played in the film by Barry Ward and Anna Berdica. They have left their home in London to live there in County Leitrim, and they're really enjoying their new lifestyle there, you know, in rural Ireland. It's a much more tranquil life. It's full of kind of the small comforts, and they're surrounded by these really big personalities, these predominantly elderly male characters, but they're just so vivid, so full of life and humour. And you do kind of see resentments from the past kind of make their way into this possibly harmonious way of living. But that's kind of as much as you could go in terms of describing the plot, because Pat Collins isn't really worried about, you know, event or momentum in this. It's really something more about the characters and about the place.
And the small events of everyday life. In fact, I said to Pat when I was talking to him, Dave, it starts with a sunrise that isn't going to be rushed. It's going to take as long as it takes for the sun to rise. And that in and of itself already relaxed me back into my chair and said, there's not going to be a hurry on this film.
It's interesting that it relaxed you, because it actually provoked some tension within me, because I think that the problem lies with me, because it's very much, you know, like we live in a generation where there's so many things at our fingertips. I mean, to just kind of sit there quietly and patiently and be contemplative can be difficult in the modern way of life. This, of course, is set in 1980s Ireland. And yeah, those opening credits, they're so unadorned. They really take their time. And once you kind of tune into that rhythm, like, it did take me a while to tune to the frequency of this film, because it's practically somnambulant. Like, it's very much a situation where, you know, people just collide with each other quietly, and there are some bigger characters with a bit more charisma, but it's about the ordinary life. And, you know, the late John McGahern said that the ordinary is the most precious thing in life, or something that he was quite fascinated by. And yeah, this is like it's really like we, the viewer, are completely implanted into this community, and we just watch people talk to each other in these tranquil settings. And it's, you know, it's challenging in one respect, but it's quite faithful and beautiful in another.
Yeah, and to get a sense of the characters that surround these two artists, who really are from outside the community, essentially. Yes, the John Rutledge character has a connection with the place, but essentially they're outsiders at this point in time. Give us some of the people around. There's a lovely couple next door, played by Matt Dolan. What's his first name? Michael Dolan and Ruth McCabe. Then there's a character coming home, played by Sean McGinley. Who else is in there?
Yeah, and Sean McGinley's character is quite interesting in terms of he almost kind of sets the plot in motion a bit.
That's
more,
the biggest event.
Yeah,
he arrives home from
the
London.
The fact that he comes back from
Britain,
London,
England.
Yeah, and people are kind of talking about, you know, the fact that he left here and kind of betrayed us, and then you've other members in the community who are kind of welcoming him with open arms, which is quite quite interesting to kind of see those different relationships and dynamics. For my part, I thought that the character of Patrick Ryan, played by Lala Roddy, was just really, really kind of fascinating to see, because everyone else in the film is quite they really kind of appreciate having like a sense of humour, and they're kind of emphasising the levity of life, whereas this character has something of like a darker streak to him. At one point we actually visit his home, it's around December, and he's kind of giving out about Christmas and how it's not really a nice time of the year at all, and even his house is like quite dark and dismal, and I think that's very
But he has lost a brother, I think, at that point
exactly, so there is something kind of, I suppose, darker happening like in his psyche and everything, and he suffers no fool. So when this character returns from London, he's very unforgiving.
Well, in fact, let's listen to a clip which is a little exchange between Lala Ruddy. I think we hear Barry Ward's voice in the midst of this as well, but it's essentially, here's the fella coming home who thinks he's the big fella kind of thing, coming home from London for the summer. Sean McGinley and Lala Ruddy, and I think Barry Ward in the midst of this as well.
And you're still in Ford's?
Still there. They'll be in the canteen now. Over in the floors and keeping the toilets clean. Sure. So you'd hardly call it work.
Jesus. I think so many around here were forced out to England and America. You left a cracking job here netting fish to go cleaning English taxes. You made the mistake of your life when you left.
Patrick shows none of us mercy.
I tell the truth and ask no favours.
That might not always be the best approach.
Tell me then what is, lad.
Kindness. Understanding. Sympathy. Tact. Humour, maybe.
Put that out in the yard, lad.
And I don't think you'd refuse him when he tells you to put that out in the yard,
no,
lad.
Absolutely not.
That's Lala Ruddy there in the final voice that we heard in a clip from That They May Face the Rising Sun. It's an extraordinary performance from him. Dave.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, the standout for sure. And it's an ensemble piece. Everyone is pretty excellent at their part, I will say. And Lala Ruddy gets the standout in terms of having the most to do from an expressive perspective. Mm. But even like when he's being quieter, I mean, even the arduous process of just like shaving and putting his clothes on while kind of just speaking about his life, you can't really look away from the screen. Yeah. And like the clip you heard there, I mean, that's kind of this film's equivalent of a gunfight. Like that's kind of as big and explosive as it will get. But there's so much underlying there. I mean, like, you hear resentment, you hear Barry Ward, you know, his kind of attempts to just try and, you know, diffuse the situation and introduce this character to the notion of compassion. And it's not that Patrick doesn't have compassion, it's just that he finds it difficult to express himself, and as he says, you know, I suffer no fools, I ask no favours. Yeah. And you get the sense that this is someone who has lived a life and has kind of, he's a handyman now, he was once an actor, he feels like a lost soul, and I think Barry Ward as well, in his role, he has to be reactive to this, and it's a very difficult job for an actor to have, actually.
A phenomenal performance. Philip Dolan, by the way, is the title, is the name of the man who plays the character, the kindly neighbour, Jamesy. Other standout performances for you and stars on this one, Dee?
I to be honest, it's kind of hard to pick like one.
It's a real ensemble piece, isn't it?
It is really about the ensemble, and the characters are all just very warm. I'd probably give a shout out to Anna Baderka here and Barry Ward's like lead performances, because I really think that a lot of this movie is about the love that you find both in romance and kind of within the community, and the relationship between those two is just so tender and so intimately depicted. I found it really kind of beautiful. It's such a vivid world. It's a world that for that 2 hour running length you feel privileged to be a part of. It's a community where everyone gives so generously of their time, and the place where they live, it's just so inviting. You kind of wish that you could spend almost more time there. I found this to be a really extraordinary little movie. It's very, very special. I'd give it 4 stars.
4 stars. What are you saying?
In terms of performances that also stood out, I think the aforementioned Sean McGinley is absolutely brilliant in this. I mean, a veteran actor.
It's Johnny, yeah.
Yeah, and he has a scene laid on with Barry Ward where like his level of vulnerability is incredible. He almost reverts to a childlike state. Barry Ward himself has a moment where he kind of just gets a little bit sad about the idea of, you know, telephone lines being brought into the country and maybe we won't write letters anymore. This film feels about the end of eras. It feels about disconnection, yeah. And it feels about things that we can find within ourselves that we also push away as well.
Yeah.
4 stars, the more I think of it, the more it sat with me, and yeah. I think it is a beautiful work.
There's also an incredible scene, the laying out of a corpse and the gentleness and the care with which that is done. It's just beautifully done. Okay, double 4 stars then for Pat Collins's That They May Face the Rising Sun, our first film this evening. Let's move on to Challengers. Not quite at the same pace, I think it's safe to say. This is Luca Guadagnino, Call Me By Your Name, A Spear of Bones and All, to mention previous outings from him. Challengers, we're in the world of tennis. How important is the tennis? Is it important at all?
Oh, not really, I would say. I mean, I have to hand it to, in fairness, Luca Guadagnino.
Guadagnino, I'm going for.
Go for it. I've neglected to write down the name of a cinematographer here. But in fairness, the two of them together do put a lot of emphasis into making tennis look quite interesting. Like if you've ever watched a Wimbledon match, you might get the odd kind of close up of each of the players, but usually the camera is to the side and you're just watching the tennis ball go back and forth. It's not a particularly, well, for me, it's not a particularly interesting sport to watch.
Lost all here, the tennis fans there, Dee.
Sorry about that. But there are a variety of angles and perspectives that he uses here. There are point of view shots from the perspective of the sidelines, each of the players. At one point, the camera is actually almost like within the tennis ball and it's bouncing all over the place. It's almost kind of dizzying. There's use of extreme close-ups. At one point, the character of Art Sweat kind of drops literally onto the camera, which is a bit gross. But anyway, so in fairness, like it's interesting the way that he like depicts tennis and tries to kind of give it a sense of vitality. I don't know how much tennis play we're actually seeing. Obviously, yeah. I'm not a big enough fan of the sport to know that. But I mean, it's not really about that. It's about the fact that we have 3 very attractive young actors who are involved in a kind of menage a trois. That's really what this film is about.
I said a triple-sided triangle. I actually meant a three-dimensional triangle. There are so many connections. Well, you explain them to us.
So well, I'd argue that the tennis match that kind of plays out as the framing device is quite pivotal, and I love the way it was presented. But yes, you have a love triangle here. I'm going to try and avoid tennis puns if I can. Art Donaldson, played by Mike Feist, is this career Grand Slam. He's an elite tennis player. He is married to Zendaya's character, Tashi Duncan. She was once a prodigy, but she suffered an injury. She is now his wife and his coach. And then there's a third character who is Patrick Zweig, played by Josh O'Connor, who is someone who was clearly super talented, is now a bit burnt out, down in his luck, is sleeping in his car, can't afford to even get a hotel room. And they will, of course, come together on the court, and we will then flash back over a 13-year period to see how they were once young and, you know, kind of carefree, but the decisions that they made back then are now haunting them in the present day.
They always come back to haunt you. Okay, let's have a listen to a clip featuring all 3 of them. Tashi Donaldson is the character played by Zendaya, Art played by Mike Feist, and Patrick played by Josh O'Connor. Guess what they're talking about? Tennis.
Hitting a ball with a racket is a great way to avoid having a job.
Well, that's also your problem. Because you think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing. That's why you still have that serve.
It works.
Yeah, but you're not a tennis player. But you don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
It's a relationship.
Is that what you and Anna Miller had today?
It is, actually. For about 15 seconds there, we were actually playing tennis. And we understood each other completely. So did everyone watching. It's like we were in love. Or like we didn't exist. We went somewhere really beautiful together.
Not that my tennis skills were ever up to much, but they certainly never brought me to somewhere beautiful with the person I was playing opposite. But clearly, this is a film, Dee, that is playing around with all about what it is to be human, never mind what tennis is.
I think you're giving it more depth than it deserves, to be honest. I mean, they really kind of overkill it with like the tennis puns, if I'm honest. Like there are all these euphemisms about how winning the game, you know, compared to winning at life. And, you know, we're playing people versus playing the game, because the whole idea is, you know, Tashi is playing with, you know, kind of both of these men to kind of, I don't know, I suppose for her own entertainment, but also to make them great tennis players when she unfortunately misses the opportunity. Even when she has this kind of sexy talk with the two men, it's always about their tennis ability. So it becomes, I think it becomes kind of a bit ridiculous, if I'm honest. The three of them seem to only be capable of thinking and talking about tennis or sex, and that's it.
And there was a whole big, I think there was a bit of palaver around the release of the film and how much sex was going to be involved in this, and the whole menage a trois element of it. It's got a 15A rating.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this is knowingly ridiculous. Like, Luca Guadagnino, when he made this film, like, he said he wanted to make a big, sexy tennis movie. That's what this film is. That's what it's all about. It's all about lust and desire and all that. Mm-hmm. It's a romp in many ways. But in terms of the, yeah, like, I mean, is it graphic? No, not. I didn't think so. I mean, it's more about kind of tension and teasing. It's almost a little bit chaste in terms of what you physically see on screen, if that's what you're going to see the film for. But even, like, that clip that you played, like, that the music that was being played there was almost a bit of a misnomer, because the score here is by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and for the most part it's techno. It's just pumping, pulsing techno the entire time, even drowning out the dialogue at times. This thing is, I don't think it's meant to be taken too seriously. It is about watching beautiful people clash and fall in love with each other, and who's going to end up with who, and who will win the game, and does the tennis match even matter? I thought it was an absolute delight, to be honest with you.
Right, okay. I'm trying desperately to come up with some way of asking about to serve me your stars.
I thought that there was too much corniness in its horniness to feel genuinely sexy. It's kind of like what teenagers think is sexy, I suppose. And I think that the Zendaya casting really is key here, because obviously a lot of her fandom are going to be that kind of younger demographic. For me, I suppose I found it kind of more interesting in terms of ambience and the tensions of the relationships between these three people. I thought in terms of atmosphere, it was quite interesting. If you will, the build-up was maybe far more satisfactory than the payoff. So it's 3 stars for me. It's a bit of fun, but also a bit silly.
A bit of fun and a bit silly. 3 stars, Dave?
I found the presentation to be quite thrilling. I really enjoyed the characters. They're not terribly likable people, but they are compelling, and I kind of enjoyed watching them tear their own lives apart for the sake of sport, not knowing, you know, what love really is and all that kind of stuff. The acting is really strong as well. It's one of the best Zendaya performances I've seen. And as mentioned, you know, my favourite men's double champions, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, deliver exceptional music. That's the one tennis pun I will make. 4 stars. I thought this was great.
Oh, you thought it was great. 4 stars. Challengers. Let us move then on to our final film this evening. Paul Mercier's piece about a bunch of protesters who tried to save an endangered old property by making a period film inside it. I really liked this premise.
Yeah, it's a madcap premise, actually. It reminds me of a 1995 indie film called Living in Oblivion, which stars Steve Buscemi. Essentially, that's about a bunch of ragtag filmmakers who just cannot get their film made. It's just chaotic production. Everything is falling apart behind the scenes, and that's what's happening here. It's quite inventive, yeah. So this centres on a group of protesters, a group of activists who also happen to be filmmakers.
It's an old ruin that's about to be demolished. So yeah. That's the contemporary moment, if you like.
Yeah, and they're like, we can save this house by performing a period reenactment and making kind of a dramatization slash documentary about it, about this play called, or this old story called Prospect House. So, but of course, sabotaging this production at every single turn is the egos of the people involved. And as mentioned, Barry Ward is in this one, and he's playing a markedly different role than what he's playing.
He's very much the actor in this one, isn't he? The leading man who wants everything to be his way. So we have the contemporary moment where they're all just themselves, these activists and actors, but they're also a second character, which is the characters from the story back in the 18th century, the 1790s, in and around the 1798 rebellion.
This is all going to become very confusing, because we're going to be talking about Prospect House and then the film within the film that these characters are making. And it's very interesting to see all of these very different personalities clash. So, as we mentioned, you have Barry Ward as Lorcan. He seems to think he is Robert Dawson, who is the character he's playing in this film within a film. He acts very haughty, very autocratic. His role is really just meant to be the lead actor, but he's almost kind of taken over as like the script writer and producer and director in a way, even though those roles are later contested. you have the lead actress Anna, who's played in the film by Keira Irvy, and she's kind of giving out that her character in the film, within a film,
she's constantly looking for the right motivation for
exactly.
that character.
Yeah, because within the film, her character gets abducted by Robert Dawson, and she's saying, you know, why would she fall in love with this character? She's trying to, I suppose, assert a bit of agency over it. And then you meet kind of other interesting little side characters. Like there's Joe, who's kind of our way into the story. He's played by Dara Devaney, who people might recognise from Dominion Creek and Art. He's the one that kind of wanders into the house inquiring about an artist residency, and they end up just immediately casting him.
He's very sincere. He's a totally sincere guy, and that chemistry is there between him and the Keira Irvy character.
Yeah, the character of Anna, and it's you wonder if anything's going to develop between them, but of course Anna and Lorcan are also their exes, so that's another reason why they're clashing. So this kind of reminded me of Intermission in a bit, because it has that kind of, you know, almost handheld style. It feels kind of mockumentary-esque, and you're just kind of watching a day in life.
And there's an improvised feel to some of the dialogue.
Oh, big time, and it comes from kind of the filmmakers have a theatre background, and they said
Paul Mercer and Anne Gately.
Yeah, and they said themselves, we couldn't have made this unless we had that theatre background, and it does feel like you're just watching kind of rehearsals, but in a good way. I mean, it does have a ton of energy, this does. I will agree that it can be confusing in terms of what you're watching, because it does at a certain point flip over to the dramatization / documentary, and we kind of watched a good chunk of that, to the point where I was
But doesn't it play with that idea where, you know, in the beginning in particular, where you have when the Dara Devaney character comes in and he doesn't realise, he doesn't know whether he's reading a script as part of an audition or whether he's talking to the guys standing opposite him. Let's have a listen to a scene from Prospect House. You'll hear Barry Ward as Lorcan here, Paul Reed as the character of Gary, who's the kind of writer-director of the whole crew, but they're all fighting with each other. You'll hear several inputs from people around the place giving out about what's going on and what's happening.
It's not a kidnap, it's a rescue.
What's that?
That has now become a metaphor for our cause.
So we're reenacting a rescue net?
But it's no longer a reenactment, it's a drama.
I thought it was a documentary.
It's a drama.
And Joe here is going to know the difference between truth and fact, is he?
He'll make the difference.
With no generator.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tony's organising that.
Well, has it been lent or sponsored?
Once he's finished talking to the press.
Does it even exist? Yeah. We've no light, no heat.
We're sitting on floors. We're sitting outside. We're in the basement.
What more do you want?
For crying out loud! We all knew this was going to be difficult. We all did. Okay, but just think of what we have in our grasp. Yeah, we're going to save this house. And we're going to strike a blow for the romantic ideal and a way of living that is not determined by the money men. We share a common enemy, and that fundamentally is why we're all here.
So Barry Ward, the main voice that you heard there, but a lot of the other actors who are part of the crew who are making the film, and then characters within the film itself. And then the final act of the film is actually totally set in 1799, I think it is, in fact. And it kind of gives us the resolution of the story from back then, which has echoes of what's going on in the contemporary text. Play.
And one of the little twists that I kind of love about it is that Joe, who does become something of a Jim in the Office type
That's
of character,
the Dara Devaney,
he's looking
Devaney
at the
character,
camera, what is going on here? One of the women that he kind of speaks to, who's just kind of, you know, kind of quietly, you know, taking notes and going around the production, she says that what's actually happening is she's orchestrating the whole thing, and that the film is actually a documentary about a making of the film. So it's this kind of Heart of Darkness twist, which it does end up being a documentary about the making of the
and
film.
I must say,
I mean,
what we're saying does make it sound a little confusing, but watching it, I wasn't confused at all about what was what.
Yeah, it's heavily ambitious, maybe a bit too much for its own good, because I really enjoyed that kind of first hour with the mockumentary feel and just kind of watching them clatter into each other. And then when you get the reenactment / dramatization at the end, it's still compelling, but I wanted more of where we were before. It can be very funny, though. I laughed aloud quite often.
Great lines,
Barry Ward is great as the egomaniacal Lorcan. He's really, really funny. There's a great bit where someone's trying to convince him to go along with a script change, and he's really against it. And then the guy's like, "Oh, you know, but it'll make you be a hero." And he's like, "Oh, a tragic hero, you say?" And he just watched the wheels spinning in his head as this raving egomaniac.
Right. So yeah, stars.
3 out of 5. I mean, I think it's a little bit too ambitious, but its heart's in the right place, and it is genuinely funny.
And what are you saying, D?
Yeah, it was an interesting one. It was kind of a comedic vibe, very married with a Ken Loach realist approach to the dialogue.
There was that improvised feel to some of the dialogue.
It was an interesting one, but for me, it was sometimes just a bit too messy, a bit too chaotic, and sometimes almost a bit bland. So 2.5 for me, but certainly ambitious.
All right, so that's Dee Mullumby and Dave Hanratty, challengers, and That They May Face the Rising Sun, go on general release from tomorrow. Prospect House is on limited release at the Savoy Cinema in Dublin from the 25th of April. That's today. And at the IMC Cinema in Ballina from tomorrow. Winner of Vocalist of the Year at the Jazz FM Awards in 2020, Judy Jackson grew up in Virginia playing piano and singing in the church choir. Inspired by greats like Betty Carter, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald and Nina Simone, her career started to take shape in her teens. In fact, she was just 16 when she opened for the legendary rhythm and blues and gospel singer Mavis Staples. Since that, Judy has performed with jazz legends like Guy Barker and, of course, on later with Jules Holland. Her live shows include her own interpretations of songs from jazz greats, as well as some of her own music, and I'm pretty sure that is what she will be performing at the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival when she comes here next month. She joins me this evening from London. Hi, Judy. Your album is actually the latest album, the most recent album is called My American Songbook, as opposed to The American Songbook. How does a song make it into your American songbook?
Oh my gosh, what a great question. I just wanted to make it personal, you know? I wanted songs that resonated with me, songs that felt good. Because if it feels good, it's going to sound good. So that's why I called it My American Songbook.
And I guess that kind of answers the other question that I would often have when people take on, you know, these great classic songs, as you have done here, ones that won't surprise us, you know, pieces like Stormy Weather or My Baby Just Cares For Me. But other songs there that might surprise us a little bit more, like Here Comes the Sun or Baltimore from Randy Newman. Those songs, to get into those songs, you have to find something that makes the song yours. And I guess that's what you're talking about there. If it speaks to you, you can make it yours.
That's absolutely correct. Yes.
And let's talk particularly about Baltimore, because I found that choice really interesting. As it composed by Randy Newman, but I guess for most of us, it will be Nina Simone, the opening
right.
track on her album, Baltimore. Was that where you first heard it?
That is where I first heard it. I went back and heard the Randy Newman version and absolutely love both. They're both so beautiful, so sharp, so unique, so soulful. And I wanted to do Baltimore because I am American, as you know. Mm. I'm from Roanoke, Virginia, as you just stated. And I've been to Baltimore. I've seen the struggle of that city. I know Billie Holiday's story with Baltimore as well. And I just remember growing up visiting that place and seeing some people who were really destitute and down and out. And I wanted to bring light to the situation and show that there is life after struggle, that yes, it is hard just to live, but you're not alone if you feel that way.
And it is interesting because I suppose, would it be fair to say that the early part of your life, there were definitely struggles and challenges within that before you were adopted by your adoptive parents a little later on?
100%. We lived in shelters. I remember coming home from school one day and they told me that my mom had been put into the hospital and she wouldn't be coming out. And so that's why my friend's parents adopted me, because they saw that I was going through something. So I'm ever so lucky to have found a home. But I always have had a strong community. You know that saying that it takes a village to raise a child. I really felt like I was raised by villagers. A community of people who cared about me, and especially people at the music lab as well. That's where I opened for Mavis Staples. That's where I met Snarky Puppy. That's where I met Wynton Marsalis. There was a real sense of community and love and family. So I didn't go without, but there were a lot of struggles in the beginning for sure.
Yeah, and your adoptive parents, I think, particularly your adoptive mother was particularly responsible for getting you involved in singing in the church choir and all of that type of thing. But the Wynton Marsalis gift that arrived to your door is quite extraordinary. Wynton Marsalis, of course, the great jazz trumpeter and classical musician as well. What did he send to you and why did he send it to you?
Right. So I met him backstage at the Jefferson Center after his concert. I was writing an article for my school newspaper, and I accidentally left my journal backstage. I went to retrieve it, and there he was. And he looked at me, and he said, "You look smart. Do do you think you're smart? I said, I don't know. I guess so, yeah. He said, you know what? I want to send you something. What's your address? Put me in contact with your mother and your father, because I think that you should study music in depth. You should study singing. I said, really? He said, yes, you should study Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Blossom Dearie, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Aretha Franklin. These were all of the artists who were in this box of music that he sent me, along with his own works in his book, Moving to Higher Ground, which I read, which is so inspiring. Talk about a story, talk about a journey. I took all of this information and I wrote notes on it and studied it day and night and would listen to Lady Sings the Blues and just become completely immersed with the music. And I fell in love with it. It became my life and it transferred over into my career. And I'm just ever so lucky to have met him on that day. It changed my life. That day changed my life for the better.
Was Nina Simone's Baltimore in the box as well, the album? Was it, or do you remember?
It was not.
It was not. So you got that later.
I discovered that later on my own. Yeah.
Well, the discovery you made led to it being on your current album, My American Songbook. Let's just listen to what you do with that Randy Newman stroke Nina Simone song, because I kind of have to think of it as belonging to both of them in some ways. And now you have part ownership, as we will hear. Oh, Baltimore, ain't it hard just to live? Lyrics there from Randy Newman and the song Baltimore, and sung for us there by Judy Jackson from her album My American Songbook. Those lyrics right across that opening section that we just listened to, Judy, the lyrics are as important as the music itself. How do the lyrics help you into what you do with getting that soulful nature into the piece?
The lyrics are an imperative part of telling the story. They paint the picture. So you have to articulate them in a very specific way. Beat up little seagull on a marble stair, trying to find the ocean, looking everywhere. Hard times in the city and a hard town by the sea. Ain't nowhere to run to. There ain't nothing here for free. Right?
Yeah.
So when I sing those songs, I see the picture in my head when I say those lyrics, and I hope that the audience then can see that as well. As I am saying those words, they can visualize the hooker on the corner waiting for the train. They can see and smell the drunk lying on the sidewalk sleeping in the rain, the people hiding their faces and hiding their eyes because the city's dying and they don't know why.
I mean,
and
it's
then boom, you're into old Baltimore. Yeah.
But it's extraordinary that there you are sitting, you know, wherever you are in London this evening, and those lyrics are very much at the front of your mind. You can recite them as if it is a piece of poetry. But I was also really taken by the arrangement, the musical arrangement in underneath you there. You obviously have an extraordinary set of musicians playing with you. Who's coming with, who will be playing with you when you come to Wicklow?
Yes, I will be having my dear friend Jamie Safir on piano, Michele Montoli on bass, and William Cleesby on the drums.
And is that who we just heard on the album? Or certainly people who can...
That's correct.
Yeah. Well, the treat of those things is quite extraordinary in my mind. You've spoken about the early part of your life that was quite a nomadic. You talked about your mother being in the shelter and things like that, I think you were living in the same places at the same time. That nomadic aspect of your early childhood, how do you think it has fed into your career and the way you perform right now today?
I think it's made me very flexible. I can adapt. I'm a chameleon. I can find myself in any situation and figure out how to survive and play and move and exist in that room, in that place, with different kinds of people from different walks of life. I can exist in any situation happily and healthily, strong and freely, because of how I grew up.
And when it came to writing your own work, because I'm just looking down my... With you, in fact, I think, is that the only song on the album that is your own? How different is it for you when you also write the song and perform it from performing the works of others?
It's a great question. It's still a similar approach. You're still a storyteller.
Mm.
But this time it's even more personal because they are your stories. Sometimes you're telling other people's stories that still connect with you and resonate with you. Sometimes you're telling your own story. And so that's what I would say would be the difference, is what kind of story are you telling and whose perspective is it from?
And I want to finish up with the song that opens the album, in fact, because it's so hopeful, and it has, you know, given the difficult start that you had to where you have brought yourself today, the song "Here Comes the Sun" seems to it shows to me such a positive side of you. Why did you want to open the album with that particular song?
I absolutely love singing "Here Comes the Sun." I've been doing it for years. We did it on tour with my first Nina Simone tour, "Little Girl Blue," and my band just sounds absolutely incredible on that. I love the improvisational bit that we do at the end. I thought it would be a great opener because it's light, it's beautiful, it's musical, it's jazzy but soulful and a bit poppy as well. So I thought it was just a perfect blend of everything to open the album with, and that's why I went with that one. Ironically, yes, it is George Harrison, so it's not really an American songbook song, but I still snuck it in there and called it my American songbook.
Yeah, well,
why I went with that one.
Yeah, well, did you hear the song in America? Yeah,
I did.
You've been singing it, therefore it qualifies for your American songbook.
Yes.
I'm with you on that. Judy,
okay, awesome.
Lovely to have spoken with you this evening. I'll give people out the details of your event, where it's happening. Thanks for speaking with us, and we'll finish up by listening to Judy Jackson and that opening track on her album, My American Songbook. This is her version of "Here Comes the Sun." Oh, it sure is all right. That version of "Here Comes the Sun" from Judy Jackson. That is the version that is on her album, My American Songbook. And hopefully that is the version that people will hear when Judy comes to the Tramway Theatre in Blessington on Saturday, May the 18th, as part of the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. You can find out full details of that gig and indeed everything happening at the festival on the website westwicklowfestival.com. And staying with music, May the 10th sees the release of the latest album from Villagers. That album is called That Golden Time. The band first came to prominence in 2010, of course, with the release of their debut album, Becoming a Jackal. That album went on to receive widespread critical acclaim, shortlisted for the Mercury and Choice Music Prize. Villagers went on to be nominated twice for the Mercury Music Prize, and in 2013 won the Choice Music Prize for Best Album and two Ivor Novello Awards for Best Song and Best Album. 2024 is shaping up to be a special year for Villagers, as they have announced their biggest headline show to date. That will be at the Trinity Summer Series in Dublin. That gig is on June the 29th. But before that, the album release and before the album release, and that concert in Trinity, Conor O'Brien will join us live in Studio One in the RT Radio Centre on Tuesday, May the 7th, to launch the new album, That Golden Time. If you would like to be part of that audience on the night, join us in Studio One. We have a limited number of tickets to give away, and if you want to be in with a chance of being there with us, text your name, your number and your email to 51551. The launch of Villagers' new album, That Golden Time. By the way, if you can't make it on the night, we will of course be broadcasting our special Villager show live, usual time of 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. Gammy is a new play from Kate Finnegan. It's a portrait of an Irish contemporary rural female fueled by pain and rage. It intertwines themes of isolation, trauma and the quest for redemption, looks at those with unfulfilled potential and the ache of being left behind. We first meet the character of Gammy. She's working in her mother's shop. She's stuck. She's never grown up. She's 31 and she's missing some teeth. But on that day, she decides she's had enough and takes drastic action. Delighted to be joined by the writer of Gammy. Kate Finnegan is with me in studio this evening. She is quite a character who you have given, Kate, in your writing of this, quite a set of challenges. But this started as a short story.
It did, yes. And also, it's a comedy too. So yes, it sounds pretty heavy and dark, but I promise you it's also quite funny.
Yeah. Oh, it is funny, yes.
Yeah, so it did. It started as a short story like maybe a year and a half ago, and I was kind of just writing it in the background. I was working with a great director, Wayne Jordan, and one of the days we're in rehearsals for another thing, and I just said, oh, I have this short story. It's a bit weird. It's a bit dark. Can I read it to you? And that's how it started.
And you're a performer yourself. So at what point did Wayne said you might think of this as a play then, did he?
Yeah, he just was like, okay, keep writing. There's something in it. And yeah, I've never really considered myself a playwright in any sense. Like I perform, I act, I do aerial dance, I do lots of bits and bobs. So it was my first kind of outing as a playwright. And I think I didn't give myself any pressure as well to say, okay, this has to be a play, this has to be a thing. So I think there was a lot of kind of joy in then the process of writing.
And had you any, you know, feeling within yourself, and I might perform this myself, or did you all the time think of it as something you would hand over?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's funny, yeah, like as an actor, when I was writing it, I just never saw myself in it because I wanted to just explore how much I could do with my writing and kind of not hold back as well, thinking, oh, I'm going to have to say this, I'm going to have to do this. So there was a lot of kind of freedom in that as a writer.
So therefore you said somebody else will have to do this. And in this case, it's Emer Keating.
Yeah, Emer Keating, she's fantastic. She's from Mullingar, so from the Midlands where the play is based. And yeah, she's a fantastic actor. She really brought Gammy.
Was there a specific inspiration for the character of Gammy? Because, you know, I suppose we can all think of those characters, male and female, but you have given us this. It's more unusual, I think, to see the isolated female character from the Midlands or from the small Irish town.
Yeah, I suppose like my main influences when writing it was a film, the film Garage by the Mark O'Halloran film.
Which was about the male version.
Yeah, the male version, I suppose. And other writers like Donal Ryan, they kind of talk about a lot of rural characters that kind of get left behind or have like lost, you know, they don't get to fulfill their kind of life. They don't get to kind of go outside or leave, and it kind of just explores that.
I was talking to you just before we came to air. I said, can we talk about the dog? And I think it's important because we want to give a sense of the mother, the nature of the relationship between Gammy, the young woman, and the mother.
Yes.
It's extraordinary. But if you tell us what the mother does to the dog, we'll get a sense of the mother's character. The mother isn't physically present in the play because it's just Emer.
It's a one-woman monologue show. And I guess this kind of is a callback to how maybe brutal the mother is. So Gammy grew up with hens in the back garden, and she had a dog called Minnie. And so one of the days, Minnie killed a hen in the backyard. And as punishment, the mum, Gammy comes home from school. She sees kind of feathers and wings everywhere, and she realises that the dog has killed a hen. So the mother is raging at this because she doesn't want any of the hens killed. So she needs to teach the dog a lesson. So she gets the remains of the hen and she stitches them together and puts it to Minnie's collar to teach the dog a lesson. So, yeah.
Needless to say, the dog's spirit is absolutely broken by all of that.
Yeah.
But if she's prepared to do that to a dog, we can leave it to the imagination as to what she was prepared to do to her daughter. We also, again, I don't think it's quite early on, we learn that Gammy is pregnant. And we learn as the play goes on, we learn about the potential father there. She really is given quite a set of challenges to get past, isn't she? You do that.
Yeah, definitely. Like she's one of those characters that, you know, blends into the background that people don't really take notice of. And she's just kind of pushed to the brink where she's no other choice but to do
The terrible things that come her
but
way.
But it's a comedy.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to talk about, because there is one character, is it Amy is her name, I think, if I remember. And Amy comes into the shop regularly and kind of tries to, I felt to me she was really trying to connect with Gammy, but Gammy was having none of it, because is she a yoga teacher, have I made that up?
Yes, kind of a dance teacher. I guess I brought the Amy character into Gammy's world. Kind of she represents the kind of contemporary Ireland, and I'm interested in like the kind of rural Irish world where, you know, a lot of people are after they've gone travelling and whatnot, they come back and relocate back to the countryside. And I mean, it's great in one way because they really re-energise the place with, you know, like bougie cafes and like sauna boxes and whatnot.
Yes.
Like things that are kind of popping up around the countryside now, which are great things. But then that kind of portion of rural Ireland that are a bit reluctant to that change and maybe a bit resentful of it. So Gammy really represents that kind of reticence against change. And Amy, she's very confronted by Amy because she just thinks her yoga dance classes are really weird and why would you do that?
Well, the other side of it is like if Gammy has been at home all this time, she has been left behind.
Yeah, in that fashion.
And then when you see somebody else coming in, kind of new broom sweeping clean,
yeah,
you might understand a little bit of resentment.
And yeah, and I think like Amy's intentions are, you know, good. Like she wants to help Gammy in whatever way she can. But I think that kind of comes across a little bit like pity, and it's a tiny bit patronising for Gammy to take that, and she's not willing to take that. So that's, she just kind of pushes that help away.
Yeah, and you're from Westmeath, isn't it, yourself? Yeah.
Meath.
Oh,
yes,
oh,
but just on the...
Big mistake, that one.
Yeah, well, just right on the border there. So I'm at Oldcastle, so...
Right,
yeah.
So you're in... the west of Meath.
Yeah, the west of Meath, yes. But technically right,
west,
yeah.
West Meath itself. No, but because there is part of the comedy and part of the joy of the piece is that kind of turn of phrase. It's not that it's particularly very strong in terms of accent, but it has that lovely turn of phrase that somebody in a small town and in several small towns might have.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think that was important to like really keep that authentic voice, and it's important for Gammy's world. And I suppose for the comedy as well, you know.
And it also is a little, then it's a little kind of praise to your own place of upbringing. You also had to be very clear, and let us be clear about this. This is not based, your mother never took a chicken and tied it to
no,
your dog
oh
when
God.
You were in primary school.
My poor mum, yeah.
Did you have to explain to her about, because obviously, you know, if you see a writer writing about a mother-daughter relationship, you think, oh, right, has this something to do with the mother?
No,
not
like
at
I
all.
Can't stress enough. My mum is like one of the most loveliest people you'll ever meet. She's just fabulous. And she came to see the show and the project there 2 weeks ago. And she was so... lovely. Like she came in with like she makes homemade jam. So she has like her own little stickers, her home branding for Colette's raspberry strawberry jam. So she
You got the plug in for Colette's jam tonight.
If you and so she came to the show and she brought jam for everyone, for all the tech crew, for the director.
I thought you were going to say there was jam for everyone in the audience.
No, that'd have been a bit too far. But no, she brought it for like the whole crew, for Emer the actor, got amazing director Laura Sheeran. Who's directing Gammy,
and it's heading off to Galway. You're in to tell us about that Galway run tonight.
Yeah.
Would you bring it home? Would you like to bring it to Meath?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, getting the regional venues, we will be presenting it in Sligo as well. But
all right,
for Corridor Arts Festival. So yeah, they'll be releasing their programme. That's in July. But yeah, definitely. I think getting it to regional venues is really important.
Yeah, because while it is set in Meath, it could actually be any small Irish town.
Yeah,
that's it. Thanks for coming in to us this evening, Kate.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Kate Finnegan. And Kate's play Gammy will be at the McLally Theatre as part of the Galway Theatre Festival. And that runs from May the 9th through until May the 11th. GalwayTheatreFestival.com for full details on that. And watch out then for the other festivals. Gammy is the title of the play from Kate Finnegan. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will be back with you as usual tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1, when, among other things, we will have our album reviews. Pet Shop Boys, St Vincent, Iron and Wine will be the three albums up for review.